Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Today's guest, award-winning photojournalist Joanne MacArthur, documents our complex and contradictory relationship with animals around the globe. Over the past decade, she has photographed animals in 25 countries. Her beautiful photos show hopeful stories about ordinary people and advocates who work to save and protect animals. Her haunting photos expose the harsh treatment of animals in slaughterhouses, zoos and aquariums, industrial animal farms, and research labs. Joanne MacArthur says her work aims to break down the barriers that allow us to treat animals as objects and not as sentient beings. Joanne MacArthur is an award-winning photographer, author, and educator who has documented the plight of animals. Joanne is the founder of We Animals. It's a project about the relationships between humans and animals. She's co-founder of the Unbound Project, which documents the lives of women who are on the front lines of animal advocacy. And she's also the author of two books, We Animals and her most recent Captive. Joanne's work is the subject of the documentary The Ghosts in Our Machine, and you can see the trailer for that and her new book Captive at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Joanne. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to have you back, and I want to congratulate you for winning the Wildlife Photographer of the Year People's Choice Award for your touching black and white shot of Pickin, a young gorilla, and her caretaker, Apollinaire, and it is on our website. It's the main photo we chose today. It's such a loving photo. Tell us about the story behind that photo.
Sure. I was volunteering at Ape Action Africa in Cameroon, and that's often how I do my work. It's, you know, I'll decide to go and volunteer somewhere for a month or 6 weeks. And my trip coincided with the big move of these juvenile gorillas who've been rescued from the bushmeat trade. And they were being moved from a smaller enclosure to a 200-acre, fantastically huge sanctuary enclosure. The gorillas were sedated for the move, but Pickin woke up early from the sedation, which is, you know, you should never get in a car with a gorilla. So that's where I took that picture. I was in the truck with the gorilla, but because she was in the arms of her caretaker, Apollinaire, she didn't freak out, thank goodness. So she sort of looked up woozily, and he also realized this could be an alarming situation, but he just, you know, held her tenderly and looked at her tenderly. And the moment that I caught there is them looking at each other. Obviously, the tender gaze between friends, and she went back to sleep.
And what I loved about the photo and the story behind it is when you won the award, Joanne, you actually asked Apollinaire, Pickin's caretaker, to share his story and to talk about his relationship with Pickin.
Yeah, it's really important, you know, for the people in my pictures as much as possible to do the talking instead of me. And we interviewed him, and it turned out to be just such an incredibly beautiful interview. I mean, he also, without getting too personal, was, you know, orphaned by civil war in Chad, and he fled from Chad. And so he knows about losing parents tragically, and that's what happened with Pickin as well. She was orphaned by the bushmeat trade. We don't know if her parents were killed in front of her or what happened. But yeah, he sees these gorillas as his children. He's known them forever. He's looked after them and raised them for years. And so there's a lot of tenderness there, and he speaks about that.
You know, the other thing that your photos do, besides just grabbing someone's attention, seeing Pickin hugging her caretaker, Apollinaire, you also write about the backstory. You write that in Cameroon and other African countries, the poaching of primates for the bushmeat trade has reached epidemic proportions. Bushmeat refers to the practice of hunting and killing wild animals to sell as meat in both the country of their origin and for export. You write that because the hunting is indiscriminate and infants don't have much flesh, many baby apes are orphaned and left to die in the forest, or they're brought back to the cities to be sold as pets after their mothers are killed.
Exactly. I really appreciate that you read that because that's the backstory there, and there always is a story. So whatever it is that I'm photographing, whether it's animals orphaned from the bushmeat trade or pigs in gestation crates and all sorts of countries around the world, the story that I'm telling is often about us. It's we animals. Mm-hmm. It's not all, you know, so much about those animals. It's what we do to them. It's how we, you know, take away all of their autonomy. We take away their lives. And so that's always the bigger picture that I am pointing towards.
And there's something so incredible happening right now. Because of social media, we are learning more than ever about the treatment of animals. Photographers like you and activists are documenting what it looks like as an animal is on its way to a slaughterhouse, or how is an animal treated in a fur farm. I mean, just yesterday, actually, I ran into a march of people in San Francisco who were celebrating the fact that San Francisco just became the first city in the country to ban fur. And all of these people, I met this woman who's been working on this for 18 years. So you've got that happening, so much awareness raising. At the same time, a new study just came out from Voiceless Animal Cruelty. It's an index, and it found that the United States has ranked as the second worst country in the world for animal cruelty. And then the Trump White House just got rid of Obama animal welfare rules that were supposed to apply to organic livestock to minimize stress and promote well-being. We can talk about that later in the show. But how do you see this all playing out? On one hand, there's so much awareness raising. On the other hand, we're seeing massive cruelty.
Yes. Okay. So many good points and interesting points made there. But yes, it's a very interesting time historically right now for animal rights. And it's a great place for us to be because there's just like this massive ebb and flow of things getting better and getting worse. In growing economies, we are seeing the rise of factory farming. So it's on the rise in, for example, India and China. But also on the rise is vegetarianism and veganism and awareness about animal sentience. Ethology, which is the study of animal sentience and intelligence, is a growing field. And so it's becoming harder and harder to deny that animals are intelligent, sentient, and deserve at least some kind of respect from us. So it's a big, busy time in history right now for animal rights. We are seeing the growth of animal laws. We are seeing things moving back and forth, and that's why we need more people on, you know, involved right now, because that's how we're going to keep things actually moving forward.
And the same applies to your photos. In your haunting photos, many of them are hard to look at. You expose the harsh treatment of animals in industrial farms, research labs, slaughterhouses, zoos. But then you have these beautiful photos showing animals in animal sanctuaries and rehabilitation centers around the globe. What is that like for you to be in both worlds?
Just to address part of what you said here, I think it is really important for me and all of us to show the good with the bad. I wish that I could, you know, show someone a picture of five hens in a crate, and they would be incensed by seeing that and then, you know, refuse not to eat those animals or, you know, change something. But that's not the way the world works, as I have learned. Often these images paralyze people. Okay, so what are we supposed to do about that? That's like the golden key here for all of us documentarians. How do you reach people? How do you get them to not turn away? And part of that equation is showing the good, which empowers people, makes people happy, and people are moved by happiness just as they're moved by seeing the images of sadness. And so I go to the sanctuaries, I photograph rescue missions, whether it's animals rescued from bushmeat or a puppy mill seizure where over 100 animals are removed, because my hope is that we will see these people taking positive action and think, hey, I didn't know I could do that. I want to do that too.
In your book, Captive, you joined forces with the Born Free Foundation to document zoos across Europe, and you spent months on the road looking at what it's like to be an animal in captivity. We're now having a very mainstream conversations about zoos and zoo reform. And in the book, in one of the videos that you did, you said that the animals in these pages ask us to look, really see, and to not turn away. Can you talk about that? How can you make sure that we actually look at these photos and spend a little bit of time with the photo and think about it rather than just turning away?
Yeah, well, again, that's the key, isn't it? That's the key we're all looking for. I do think it's important to meet people where they are at. In a way, the book does that. The book is my contribution to this mainstream conversation about the ethics of captivity, as you've just pointed out. This is something that we are finally talking about. It's because of films like Blackfish. It's because of, you know, the shooting death of Harambe the gorilla and these kind of things that have pushed this conversation to the mainstream. So I thought, okay, there's room for this. There's room for me to now do a book about this topic. The book does make us feel uncomfortable because I'm like the bad guy going into the zoos and not focusing on the things they want me to, like beautiful portraits of gorillas or their conservation efforts, which are few and far between. So I go and I photograph and film the pacing animals, the repetitive behaviors, the sadness, the despondency. And I also photograph how we interact with what we're seeing and who we're seeing in front of us. You know, for the most part, we're just taking selfies and we're not paying any attention at all. And I'm doing that so that we can all question this idea that zoos are there for our education and that, you know, we become better people, more caring people from seeing animals on display. The book is very much about showing that that's not the case.
Tell us about Gina. This is a very old elephant who has lived alone for 15 years. She has spent her life pacing back and forth in a tiny dirt enclosure without even a tree to stand under. And you went back to that zoo 3 times and sadly always saw Gina doing nothing because there was nothing to do.
That's exactly it. I'm so glad you've spent time with this book, obviously, because Gina in particular really moved me. She's been there for a very long time, but she's been alone at the zoo for 15 years. There is a male on the other side of the wall, but they don't have access to each other because when he's in must, he's dangerous to her. He could injure her. And so on the other side, the male is just like feeling his way along the walls with the trunk, like, because he can smell her. He knows she's there. And she just, you know, paces the same circle in the dirt all day. And when you go back to a zoo, these behaviors and this loneliness really, really hits you. The thing about our visits to zoos is that we spend 30 seconds, maybe a minute, at any given enclosure. And if it's a little bit sad, if it's a little bit distressing, you know, because the sadness is obvious if we just choose to open our hearts to it and look, it is obvious. But then we just leave because we don't go to the zoo to be sad. We go for a day at the park with the kids, you know, something entertaining. And the thing is, when you go back over and over and over, and I'd really like to talk with zoo staff about this, like, what is it like for them? I think they believe they're doing the best they can for these animals, but from my point of view, I go back and, oh my gosh, you know, like, okay, I've been watching Gina for a half hour. Oh my gosh, it's been an hour. And then, you know, I go to my hotel, I choose what I want for dinner, I choose who I want to talk to, I choose when I get up in the morning, but, you know, she has no autonomy. And then I go back the next day and she's doing the same thing. And then, you know, it really starts to hit you with the hours become days and become years. And when you put yourself in the place of the animals and try and imagine what it must be like for animals like Gina to be alone for 15 years, again, without even a tree to stand under, it's a really dismal experience, and we can do better. We absolutely must do better, especially for these incredible, intelligent animals like elephants.
There's another story in Captive about Miko Luka, a baboon who is kept alone in a terribly small enclosure. And when you met Miko Luka, he groomed your hands and your arms, and you write that you went back to see him 4 times in one day, and he was clearly so happy to see you. Can you talk about that experience, what it was like when he groomed your hands and your arms? And then this is the awful part of what you do. You eventually had to leave.
Yeah, with animals in zoos, generally, or almost always, you're not allowed to touch the animals, and that makes perfect sense. However, people at the zoo and regular visitors said, oh, that's Miko Luka, and he's very friendly, and he just wants to groom people, and in fact, he's allowed to, you know, we're allowed to put our arms near the bars, and he can groom us. So I thought, oh, well, I have an opportunity to not just for once, you know, take sad images, or rather images of these sad animals, but, you know, I could maybe bring this animal a little bit of joy and give him what he wants. And so I offered my forearm, and he, you know, smacked his lips appreciatively, and he didn't want to be groomed. He just wanted to groom. And so, I, you know, that happened for about 5 minutes. And then, you know, I had to keep working. And he watched me go, and I watched as I walked away, just observing again this really, really small cage with a concrete floor, no enrichment. And I looked at him in there, and I just couldn't bear it. And so I went back, and, you know, the more I went back, the more he recognized my face and knew that there would be some reward in the interaction between he and I. And unfortunately, the result of my behavior was that he was stressed out when I left. And when I started walking towards the exit at the end of the day, he climbed as high as he could to, you know, strain his neck to watch me go. And I was looking at him as well. And, oh, my goodness, I just can't really bear to think that he's there alone, you know, day after day. And it's the same thing with Gina. Their life is a life alone every single day for many years. We get to come and go. And to your point about, you know, me leaving, everywhere I go, I leave. It is the hardest part of my work because, you know, I care about the individuals I'm photographing. I care about their quality of life, and I care that they are lonely or depressed, and my job is to try to document that, try to capture some aspect of their personality that I can show to the world, and hopefully get people to, you know, get a glimpse as well and to care as well. But it is definitely the hardest part of my work, that I leave all these interesting and intelligent animals who deserve so much more than what I'm able to give them.
Joanne MacArthur is an award-winning photographer. We're talking there about her latest book, Captive. She joined forces with the Born Free Foundation to document zoos across Europe. She spent months on the road looking at what it's like to be an animal in captivity. We were just talking about Gina, a very old elephant who has lived by herself for 15 years in a tiny dirt enclosure. No tree, nothing. Joanne went back to that zoo 3 times and saw Gina doing nothing. You can actually see a video of Joanne talking about her latest book, Captive, with some photos from the book at yourcallradio.org. Joanne MacArthur is founder of We Animals. It's a project about the relationships between humans and animals. She's also co-founder of the Unbound Project, which documents the lives of women who are on the front lines of animal advocacy. And she's the subject of the documentary, The Ghosts in Our Machine. You can see the trailer for that also at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question or a comment for Joanne, we'd love to hear from you. If you're an animal rights activists, or if you rescue animals or work at an animal shelter, how has being around animals really changed your relationship with animals? And what are your thoughts about the power of photographs? If you're familiar with Joanne's work, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Because of social media and activism, there's so much awareness raising now about the plight of animals, the impact that meat eating has on our environment, about animal cruelty. How has this awareness raising really changed your daily consumption, the way that you see animals? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Joanne, talk a bit about how you got in this work. Was there a moment that inspired you to dedicate your life to documenting the lives of animals?
Photojournalists are always looking for their unique story, something that they can work on long term, and that was the case with me. And there was a defining moment. It was in 1998, so that was even a few years before I really got ramped up with the animal work, but I was hiking in Ecuador, and there was a monkey chained to a windowsill, and there were a crowd of tourists around the monkey taking a picture of the animal. And I also stopped to take a picture, but I felt like an island there because I was taking a picture because I thought, well, this is really cruel, and maybe I can do something with this picture. Maybe I can show an authority. Maybe I can simply show other people and ask them to, you know, to look at cruelty, whereas everyone else was taking pictures because they thought it was cute or funny. And I thought, okay, well, actually, my point of view here in respect to the animal is more important than theirs, and perhaps I can, you know, continue to make a statement about how we use and abuse animals through photography. Mm. And away we went. I've been to almost 60 countries now. Almost 60 countries now. And I guess I really started going in 2003 after I did an internship with Farm Sanctuary. And it was there that I got really galvanized to do this work as much as I possibly could. And, it's unfortunately, there's still a lot of work to do. People that I mentor often say, well, how can I do what you do, and how can you afford to do all this traveling? And I often tell them, well, you don't need to travel this much. You can start close to home. Anyone who wants to tell the stories of animals can tell the stories of lone fish who are in jars, you know, in their home or their neighbor's home, the lonely birds who are caught in cages in our living rooms, who can't fly around, the rib fest that's happening down the street, or, you know, all the ways we use animals, and these animals are kind of invisible. So we can all do projects that make these animals visible, that get us to consider them, to even see them, because we can't even start to think about changing the world for the better for animals if we're not even seeing them yet.
Mm. Talk more about humans taking these photos. In your book, Captive, you have photographs of families taking selfies with animals behind them. And once in a while, like the website Dodo, that has incredible videos and photos of animals, shows people who will see a stranded, like a dolphin, for example, on a beach. And obviously the dolphin needs help, but the crowds are around the dolphin taking selfies. And people are kind of horrified by all of this, but it seems to be happening more and more because we live in this world now where so much is being, there's so many cameras everywhere. Can you talk a little bit about that, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, this is all indicative of the hierarchy that we have created between us and them, them being all other animals. We have been taught since childhood to objectify them, that they are there for our use, for our entertainment, and that our entertainment is more important than their lives. That's why we go to zoos and aquaria. That's why we think it's okay to do so. It's appalling and selfish behavior that we would take selfies next to a dying animal on a beach. It's, you know, just really makes me feel pretty down. I would like to think as well, and I'm sure that for every situation like that we hear about in the news, there are probably also there are probably also stories of rescue, people who are helping getting animals back in the ocean or up in the air or wherever that animal needs to go, and we're just not hearing about those.
Today we're speaking with award-winning photographer Joanne MacArthur about her work that documents our complex relationship with animals around the world. Since 2003, she has photographed animals in 60 countries, and you can find her work, a couple trailers about her work, at yourcallradio.org. One of her books, Captive, she includes photos from animals that are in zoos and aquariums, and she says that the goal is to get people to look, see, and not turn away. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Bay Area youth who live in neighborhoods that have been neglected by politicians. At Saturday's incredible March for Our Lives rally in Washington, D.C., youth from South Los Angeles to Chicago demanded gun control, but they also demanded resources, things like fully funded schools, after-school programs, good jobs. well, we've got these problems here in the wealthy Bay Area, in an area with so much wealth, far too many youth are being left behind. So we'll talk with them tomorrow about what it will take to demand change in under-resourced communities. We're also putting shows together this week about guns. We're going to talk with kids from Chicago to the Bay Area, and then we will later in the week talk about rising teacher power. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Joanne MacArthur, an award-winning photojournalist who has documented the plight of animals for more than a decade in 60 different countries. She's the author of two books, We Animals, and her most recent, Captive. Her work is the subject of the documentary, The Ghosts in Our Machine. Let's spend some more time talking about some of the more daunting photos you've taken, Joanne. As I said, San Francisco recently became the first city in the country to ban fur. You have been documenting fur farms since 2009. On your website, you've got really awful photos of mink, foxes, and raccoon dogs that were taken in Canada and throughout Europe. How are you able to get access to, for example, these fur farms?
We trespass is the short answer, because these aren't places that we are welcome. People who want to have a close look at the conditions in which these animals live are not welcome at places where we farm animals in a mass production kind of way. And trespassing is something that is part of my work, unfortunately. I mean, part of the work of many journalists, unfortunately, whether we're, you know, posing as someone else or simply trespassing. I don't like lying to people, so it's a really crappy part of my work, but my loyalty is to telling the stories of animals. So that's what we do. Often it's a situation where I go with a security team, I document all night, and then I leave with everything undisturbed. And so, yes, I have done this work across Europe and in Canada as well. And whether the farms are small, clean, or large, there's always, it's just a terrible situation for the animals. And what is interesting is that these are, this is all legal. You know, these cages we put them in, cages where they can turn around, take a couple of steps, and that's about it. That's all perfectly legal. No enrichment, no friendships, a death by gassing or electrocution, having their babies taken away, lots of cannibalism, lots of fighting, especially amidst the mink. The moms give birth to their young, and then they grow very quickly, and all of a sudden there was one in a cage, and now there are 10. And so injuries are perfectly normal. They bite away the scruffs of the necks, the ears, parts of the face. And so that's my job, is to go and show that this is the norm. This is the standard in farms across the world.
Mink crammed into a filthy cage. They're so tiny.
Yeah, and the cage is tiny. Try, with a single mink in a cage, they'll just pace back and forth. They can take a few steps in either direction, but imagine 10 mink. It's an extremely stressful situation for them. Also because they are animals who like to be near and in water. They spend a lot of their time in water. And the bottom of the cage is just mesh so that the feces can fall through. It is it's an extremely cruel thing for us to do. And we don't need to wear fur, as we all know. I'm so pleased about the ban in the U.S. Like, that's San Francisco, right?
Yes.
And then, you know, Versace and Michael Kors and all of these companies who are finally stepping up and saying, no, we're not going to do this. This is old-fashioned. This is cruel. We know it now. There's no denying it. Norway has finally said that they would place a ban on fur. They want to end fur farming in Norway by 2025, and that is a huge blow to the industry, because Norway is a huge, a famous producer of fur. And so I think and I hope that we will see the end of fur production, hopefully in my lifetime. But things are moving in that direction.
Now, these fur farms that you documented are in Canada and Europe. Are there many fur farms in the United States?
There are. There are millions of animals in fur farms across the U.S., but I have not visited them.
And do you know the differences between how animals and fur farms are treated in the U.S. versus Canada or Europe?
Yes, because I've seen the footage. If it's not my footage, there's lots of footage out there. And that's part of why I don't do it in the U.S. is because there's already a lot of material there. Laws are also very different in the U.S., and so I'm definitely wary of working there because of things like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. I could be deemed a terrorist for trespassing, even taking photos while off of a private property. So it's not a place that I'm going to work. A lot of people, however, have documented and are documenting. The mink farms especially are the same there as what I've seen worldwide. These are places that there aren't a lot of people there. You know, these animals get fed by one person and a machine maybe once a day. They let the feces pile up almost to the bottom of the cage. Sometimes that's a meter, you know. The smell is incredible. These places are often quite far away from homes and from the road so that you can't smell. And then once you approach, your eyes start to water from the smell and from the filth. And because these animals are so much more sensitive than we are, they use their noses to navigate the world. I really feel for them. I really wonder what it must be like for them to have to live over such a mess for their entire lives.
Joanne, you just said that you won't work in the United States because of the strict laws here. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's the terrorization of dissent. And for some reason, they have been able to, you know, place all these laws. And these are laws that people are fighting. Will Potter's at the forefront of that, and many other people. They're making it illegal to take images of private property. And, you know, treating animals like private property as well. They're not property, they're individuals, and they deserve to be protected. But because we, humans, are literally eating the world to death, I mean, there's some 80 billion land animals a year that we kill for food. Our population is 7.5 billion. We're literally eating the world to death. But because we want to do that, because we want cheap meat, we are keeping animals in smaller and smaller cages. The chickens, the hens, the pigs, it's just getting worse and worse for them so that, you know, we're not using huge tracts of land so that we can keep them, keep it really efficient, keep the farming efficient, keep, you know, 300,000 birds, for example, in one shed. In fact, I was at a broiler farm just recently that had 300,000 birds in one shed. And this is what we're doing so that we can continue to eat cheap meat, and definitely has to change.
300,000 birds just in one shed.
Yeah.
80 billion land animals killed for food around the globe, but that does not include fish.
Exactly.
You have documented slaughterhouses around the globe. Here in the United States, there's the SAVE movement. And what they do is, for example, in Petaluma, there's chicken slaughterhouses. In Los Angeles, there's pig slaughterhouses. And they stay in one area as the trucks are going into the slaughterhouse, and they take photos of the animals in the truck. And they are crammed in a truck. The floor is covered in their feces. What would you say is the difference between slaughterhouses in the United States, Canada, and Europe?
They're all the same. There are smaller slaughterhouses. There are bigger slaughterhouses. But these are places where they are maximizing efficiency, getting as many animals through as they can, whether it's cattle or whether it's rabbits. And, you know, animals know what's ahead of them. I mean, I've seen it in their eyes. They're not stupid. They know what's coming. It's a terrifying experience for them. And so is the trucking and the transport to these places. I've been at the trucks along with the SAVE movement in various countries, and you know, some of these animals are being transported sometimes for days. This is the subject of some of my work this summer, actually, in Europe, is the transport for days. I mean, there's so much that goes into producing meat, and you know, if we think of the animals at all, it's often some thought about, oh, an animal in a field or an animal in a cage. But so much goes into their lives from when they're born, you know, ears tagged or beaks cut, tattoos, vaccinations, being taken away from parents, being moved this way and that, no autonomy, always questions, no answers, being trucked, being killed. And so for me, slaughterhouses, they are just one part of the whole animal experience, and not a good experience for them. I am a big fan of the SAVE movement because people go to bear witness. That's mm-hmm. the point of the SAVE movement, is to it's a place where people can go and get a glimpse of the lives of these animals and hopefully change. And I think it's really neat that, you know, it's not just animal rights people who are showing up. It's, you know, as the SAVE movement makes news and it becomes you know, a city or a town will hear that there's a SAVE group meeting Friday mornings at the slaughterhouses. They can come and say, like, what's all this about? Why are these people congregating here? And what is it that they want to see? And I'm also curious about what's going on there. And so that they can come and see. Some people go every week. Some people just go once so that they can see in community and with the solidarity of others. And then they've seen and they can bring that information into the world, tell others, or make personal changes.
And this is something that companies like Tyson and Smithfield do not want the public to see. What reaction do you have or do you get when you show people the entire process of the animal being bred, transported, and then killed? Mother Jones had a piece recently about how the USDA under Trump want to make pig processing even faster. At a typical pig slaughterhouse in the United States, 977 pigs are killed every hour. That's about 16 every minute. And this is incredibly dangerous work for the workers. The USDA wants to push an overhaul that would speed up that already frantic pace. And I'm guessing a lot of people just don't even know that 16 pigs are killed every minute at these slaughterhouses.
Well, you've said it there. I mean, you've fully said that this is a major problem, that it's dangerous. Well, obviously, it's dangerous for the animals. It just makes all the unpleasantness of their lives that much worse, first of all. And the injuries of workers is something that's very well documented, and it has been for decades. I don't know why we still need to keep coming back to this. I mean, I guess it's because, well, not I guess, I mean, it's because people aren't looking and people aren't listening. When it comes to anything animal related, we think that it's just not important. And so, yes, it's very dangerous. There are all sorts of injuries all the time at slaughterhouses. That's par for the course.
You also document sheep sale yards. You've got some photos of sheep on your website that were taken over the course of a day at a large animal auction yard in Australia. And staff told you that 32,000 sheep were bought and sold that day, most of them going to slaughter. Additionally, most of the meat would be shipped overseas. Tell us more about what you've learned about the wool industry.
The wool industry, again, if we think of these animals at all, we think, well, what's wrong with wool? We're just, you know, giving these animals a haircut. But we don't think about the beginning and to the end. And if we think about the use of animal products in the context of the entire lives of these animals, we'll feel differently. At least we should. And the shoot to which you refer was one day in Australia at the sheep sale yards, as you said, where 32,000 sheep were brought in, bought and sold and bought, and then put back on the trucks. Now, that's just one day in their lives of, you know, again, like these animals, all these animals I meet, their eyes are just full of questions, like, What are you doing next to me? What are you going to do to me? That's why, you know, when we face animals who are captive, their eyes are just so often full of fear. And that was the case at the Ballarat sale yards. There were dead sheep all over, dead and dying sheep. Wherever I photograph an animal industry, I always look for the dumpster as well, because there's always a dumpster full of animals. And sure enough, there was there as well. It was just piled high with sheep who die from injuries, breaking their legs, breaking their necks, because they're stressed out and they're jumping all over the place. The sale yards are cobblestone, and they're full, they're covered in urine and feces, so they're really slippery. And these animals are just jumping all over each other to move or to get away. The cattle dogs as well are there. They're meant to scare the sheep so that the sheep move. And so this is a really frantic atmosphere for these animals who are being sold and separated and unloaded and reloaded from trucks. Hundreds and hundreds of these animals are crammed onto trucks, and they use electric prods to get them moving. And so the experience for them is really painful and stressful. And as I said, you know, one of the just, you know, costs of doing business with this is that they're running around and breaking their legs and their necks, and they die. And so they pick up these animals and put them on the other side of the chutes. Or, you know, the sheep is just left gasping with blood running from their faces as sheep clamber over them. Like, it's really, really unpleasant, but it's the cost of doing business. When I'm there, I'm, you know, sort of the only one who is seeing things from this point of view, and that's really interesting because there's all these staff and farmers there who just do this every day, but the difference is that they see animals as products for our use, and I don't.
How did you get access to this sheep sale, Joanne? I mean, these photos are just amazing. There's sheep, they can't even turn around waiting for the auction to begin. You've got a photo of sheep herded by men and dogs, merino sheep waiting for the auction. Buyers and sellers are kind of pointing at the sheep as they're just all crammed in one section. How did you get access to this?
Oh, well, it's a public place, and I think that they have tourists there sometimes. So often I just rock up to a place and truthfully say, hey, I'm a photographer. I've never seen anything like this before. Can I come and document? And because I have a genuine curiosity, I talk to a lot of the people there. I ask lots of questions. Then I you know, end up being, you know, welcome there for a full day.
What are some of the more memorable conversations you've had?
Oh, boy. I mean, how to pick one out of 15 years of this? Well, I think going back to the workers at slaughterhouses and farms, I arrived at a broiler farm once at 4 in the morning. We were driving by the highway and along the highway, and we saw that there were trucks being loaded, and we stopped. And I walked up, and I said, you know, hey, can I photograph this? And they said, yeah, sure, come on in. They were loading 25,000 birds into trucks. They had to work really, really, really quickly, and birds were being injured. They grabbed them by the legs, and then they have handfuls, five in one hand, five in the other, hanging upside down. And then they lift them or, like, throw them into the crates and then slam the lid down, and sometimes wings are caught in, you know, in the crates, and heads are caught in the crates. And all of these men who worked there asked me if I could help them get another, help them get another job elsewhere, anywhere else. This was not prompted by me. I didn't ask them about their jobs. They just said, like, this really sucks. We don't want to do this. We are highly underpaid. This is dangerous work. We can get injured. Can you help us? And this echoes, you know, the conversation earlier, but also the book by Gail Eisnitz, Slaughterhouse, where she interviews slaughterhouse workers across the U.S. These are just really unpleasant places for people to work, and obviously terrible places for animals.
Today we're speaking with photojournalist Joanne MacArthur. She's an author and educator who has documented the plight of animals. Since 2003, she's been to 60 countries taking incredible photos, beautiful photos, very daunting photos of animals around the globe. We have a question from Fran, who says, I'd love to know Joanne's thoughts about the work of Joel Sartor and his Photo Ark series, in which he seems to work closely with some of the world's zoos to document the remaining endangered animals. He seems to have good relationships with these zoos. Joanne's work is very damning of zoos. Do you think there are any good zoos?
Okay, a lot of questions there, and that's those are excellent questions. Most zoos need to close. Most of them are unaccredited roadside zoos worldwide. Substandard cages, no enrichment, concrete floor, no friends, terrible, basically terrible places. Most zoos need to close. the larger accredited well-financed zoos can become places for animals instead of for us. I think that there is always going to be a need for places where we can look after rescued animals, animals who cannot be reintroduced into the wild. So we need to keep these facilities going as places of true conservation, true rescue, taking on more of a sanctuary model and using their facilities not in a way where the animals are overcrowded, but where the animals can have more autonomy, more privacy. And so zoo reform is a big thing right now. And I attended the Global Symposium on Zoo Animal Welfare at the Detroit Zoo just last May. And that was really interesting, hearing zoo CEOs from around the world talk about, yes, you know, the world seems to want a ban on cetaceans, cetacean breeding in captivity, and the world is really shining a light on us, and we need to step up. So that conversation is happening, and that's great. Joel Sartore's work, yeah, that's really interesting. It's very different from what I do. I am a photojournalist who goes in and document the realities of what's happening in front of me in the lives of these animals. Joel's work is in a studio with technically brilliant work, beautiful work. I think that our motives are similar and yet different. There's some common ground. I mean, he's doing it for reasons of conservation. I think that there can be a good conversation around, well, you know, is he or is the work exploiting the animals that they're photographing by virtue of putting them on like a studio, in a studio with all the lighting? I mean, how does the animal feel about that? We have a lot of photography historically and worldwide that are beautiful images of charismatic animals or any kind of animals. But historically, those images have not helped animals. It just allows us to gaze at their beauty, to revere the animals. And so what the bridge that needs to be gapped between those beautiful images is one that links us to activism, which links us to caring and to taking action. Mm. And that is what Joel is doing. He's saying, I'm going to take these beautiful images of animals so that we can care. And then there's a dialogue that's happening. This is how this animal is endangered. This is why it's important. This is why we should care. And so I think that messaging is like the most beautiful part of his work.
Well, speaking of caring, you're co-founder of the Unbound Project, which documents the lives of women who are on the front lines of animal advocacy around the globe. And I remember when you launched this project because, I mean, not only are the photos amazing, but the stories of what these women are doing around the globe are just incredible. Tell us about the Black Mambas. They're in the Balule Nature Reserve. It's part of South Africa's famous Kruger National Park.
Yeah, oh, that was a really fun story. And the Black Mambas are a very famous anti-poaching unit right now because they are made up of all women. So, Unbound is photos and storytelling and articles about the interesting women worldwide who are on the front lines, whether they are part of an APU or whether anti-poaching unit or whether they are lawyers or neuroscientists or writers or artists. And sometimes the photos can be really strong because, you know, the situation I'm going into to photograph them is quite visual, like women who are out on a snare removal patrol, and that's how I photographed the Black Mambas. And then sometimes, you know, I'm photographing a woman in her office or just simply doing a portrait because her work is, you know, not some, you know, some place with a sexy backdrop, but it's like literally she's at her desk all day advocating for animals. So sometimes the photos are really strong, and then sometimes and often it's like the story that is the strongest part. But it's a really timely project. I really do love this project. Women have always been the larger numbers in terms of people on the front lines of animal advocacy in Europe and North America. The statistic is that the movement has been made up of 60 to 80% women, and so we want to celebrate that. Often there is a man at the top of an organization, and the women are sort of underrepresented, even though the numbers are really big. And so this is a celebration of the inspirational women, the trailblazers, and also the women who are just quietly working behind the scenes.
Yeah, this was an amazing one. The Mambas are among South Africa's first black women to work as rangers. And you can see these incredible photos, unboundproject.org. Joanne, we have about a minute left. And so much has changed since you started doing this work. Since then, you've been to 60 countries taking photos of animals. What are your hopes for the future now that there's now that we have access to so much information, including your photographs?
Well, it is exciting because this path for me is simply about making the lives of animals visible. And since I started, this has changed drastically. And so we just need to continue on this path. The visibility of animals, you know, be it through film or photography, is just one of the pieces of the puzzle when it comes to animal justice worldwide. And so it's an exciting place to be right now. If you are a visual storyteller, I encourage lots more people to take part because we are a part of an important part of the puzzle that's creating change for all animals.
Well, Joanne, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Joanne MacArthur is an award-winning photographer who has documented the plight of animals for more than a decade. She has been to 60 countries. She's the founder of We Animals, a project about the relationships between humans and animals, and co-founder of the Unbound Project, which documents the lives of women who are on the front lines of animal advocacy. And if you go to our website, yourcallradio.org, you can see the trailer for the documentary, The Ghosts in Our Machine, and find out more about her new book, Captive. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Bay Area youth who live in neighborhoods that have been neglected by politicians. At Saturday's March for Our Lives rally in Washington, youth from South Los Angeles to Chicago demanded gun control, but they also demanded basic resources, fully funded schools, after-school programs, internships, and good jobs. Here in very wealthy Bay Area, unfortunately, far too many youth are being left behind. So what will it take to demand change in under-resourced communities? Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to our podcast or download our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Raz is on produced today's show. Josh Wilner is our social media producer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thank you for joining us.